We start off 2024 by considering one approach to addressing the housing crisis. Many affordable housing units are in jeopardy due to challenges such as aging infrastructure, financial constraints, and the rising costs of renovations. Rental Rescue is a nonprofit that works with the public and the private sector to maintain and increase the number of affordable rental housing units. Crystal Valencia is the founder and managing director of Rental Rescue. She's a housing activist working predominantly in the Hamilton and Oakville areas. One of her goals is to preserve existing affordable housing units by safeguarding them against deterioration, which often leads to rent evictions and rental increases. Now over to our moderator, Phil Ault.
Good morning, Guelph, and welcome to the first Breezy Breakfast of 2024. We are down at Rise and Shine in beautiful downtown Guelph with a small but mighty group today. I think that the weather might have something to do with that, or people are just sleeping in after New Year's, although if they're sleeping in after New Year's, they were having way too much fun. Before we begin, I would like to do a brief territorial acknowledgement. As we gather, let us take time to reflect on our privilege to live and work in Guelph, a city built over rich Indigenous histories. We are guests here, and we should reflect upon the responsibility to care for this land, the people who live here today, and the generations to come. If our actions today can move us toward reconciliation, we should take pause and make those decisions with intention and gratitude. And with that, I am thinking with those who have less, and hoping that those who have more can support others. And along that line, I would be remiss if I didn't state that 2024 must begin with a request for funding for Breezy Breakfast. As you know, we operate on a shoestring, offering only minimal honoraria for those who are guests who are not working at full-time jobs or are working within community groups. Beyond that, our expenses are low, except we must pay for Zoom. We must pay for some of our technology, including this brilliant used technology that we are using here today. So if you can see your way fit, we would love donations. We will admit that we do not give tax receipts. We are not charitable. We are not for profit. We are just a ragtag group of volunteers. We keep the news flowing in Guelph. And with that, I'd like to introduce our topic and our speaker today. Housing. It's a ubiquitous topic and challenge. Seemingly, there are many opinions and, unfortunately, there is little action. The provincial government has pledged to provide 1.5 million homes, yet fewer than 100,000 have been built this year, and the time frame is short. We are looking at a need for approximately 200,000 homes to be built each year between now and 2031. Financing and workforce issues have been predominant in holding up construction of any new homes. But the issue has been conflated. The issue is not housing, it's affordability. We talk about affordability, but we never truly address it, because there is a role for governments of every level and manifestation. Cities, we can admit, do not have the money, yet are called upon to open up more land and ensure that developers are able to put many, many homes in the ground. The challenge with that, however, is that developers are not in the business of nonprofit and subsidized and supportive housing. What they're in the business of is making a profit through housing. The real culprits in this, in many respects, are the provincial and the federal governments. And regrettably, they are mostly dedicated to deflection and public statements that are, in many respects, doing nothing more than projecting a principle of well-being and intention, but not providing funding. Joining us today is Crystal Valencia from Rental Rescue, who will tackle this issue from her unique perspective. Crystal will note, many affordable housing units are in jeopardy due to challenges such as aging infrastructure, financial constraints, and the rising cost of necessary renovations. I would be remiss if I did not explain that Rental Rescue is a nonprofit with the main goal of preserving existing affordable housing units and safeguarding them from deterioration or gentrification. I would also be remiss if I didn't point out that Crystal has had many experiences with this in Hamilton, where she lives, where there's a fairly active organization working to ensure that housing is preserved and that housing is available for those who need it. If people in Guelph think that we have a problem with affordability and homelessness, they need look no further than Hamilton to see that Guelph's problem pales in comparison to much of what is going on around the country, and dare I say that is occurring with, I believe, great misfortune in Edmonton today. So with that, I'd like to pass it over to Crystal and welcome you. We are happy to hear from you, and we are looking forward to your spiel. Why should we look at rental rescue as an option for us in Guelph?
Thank you very much, Phil. I really appreciate you having me here, and Mike for the introduction. And just quickly going through rental rescue, and you know what we do is addressing the affordable housing crisis, where we're dedicated to revolutionizing the affordable housing sector. And with the affordability crisis, as you mentioned, escalating, the need for a comprehensive, sustainable, and collaborative approach to housing preservation has never been greater. Rental Rescue is poised to deliver a groundbreaking turnkey innovation that will tackle this pressing issue head on. I don't need to tell the people here and in general that there is a need because there's a housing shortage of unprecedented proportions, and a significant number of affordable units are in jeopardy due to those various challenges, as you mentioned, Phil. Nonprofit community-based organizations and housing providers are struggling to retain and maintain affordable units, and municipalities recognize the need for disruptive solutions that not only protect these valuable assets, but also enhance them to meet the evolving demands of our communities. And what Rental Rescue does, and what the challenge we really try to, we recognize we're facing, is acquiring properties in Canada's rapid real estate market. And in Canada, nonprofit groups are challenged by the fast-paced real estate markets, where they often lack the capacity needed to secure residential and commercial properties, especially in neighborhoods where real estate values are rapidly appreciating. And in these competitive markets, private investors frequently outpace community developers when properties become available. And in evaluating the solution, we, especially in the Canadian housing landscape, we recognize the struggles faced by nonprofit, public sector, governments, and municipalities. We seek to develop and retain affordable housing for low and moderate income households, but tend to be hindered by regulatory burdens that accompany public subsidies. And these regulations slow the process of property acquisition in highly competitive markets. We at Rental Rescue understand the unique challenges of the housing market, and to support non-market developers, we aim to provide a network of flexible sources of private capital, empowering them to compete effectively. And we inject these private funds which come with fewer regulatory and reporting demands, and offer a solution that keeps pace with the dynamic Canadian real estate environment. And this approach allows nonprofits and private sectors investors to collaborate with governments to respond swiftly to opportunities and make housing initiatives more efficient and successful. And our turnkey collaborative and scalable solution addresses the multidimensional aspects of affordable housing preservation, where we offer a systematized pathway for transitioning housing from for-profit and to nonprofit entities through five key elements, and that's comprehensive financial modeling, risk assessment tools, energy and design efficiencies, ownership transitions, and our turnkey solutions. I'm not going to go through all five of them, but specifically, I wanted to mention the flexible turnkey solution, where we offer a versatile a la carte menu of services that allows stakeholders to collaborate and select the specific solutions that align with their objectives. And we do not work in a parachute in approach, as most agencies can. And the collaboration with local stakeholders, including market players, nonprofit tenant groups, and labor movements, ensures a bottom-up approach where we prevent delays associated with a top-down strategy and aligns with the existing systems, allowing us to work within local context. So we really focus on affordable housing preservation, enhanced accessibility, improve sustainability, increase collaboration, and addressing the UN SDGs. I think I wanted to really open up to everyone and understand kind of tell me what the challenges are that Guelph is experiencing, and how can we support potential resolutions, especially in trying to, you know, bring more money into community assets and supporting the community lower income overall in housing. So that's and especially, as you know, Phil, from places like, you know, there are tent cities and other places that are kind of popping up. We're experiencing a huge amount of predatory rent eviction models, which exploit some of our society's most vulnerable individuals. And while advocating for necessary rent eviction legislation is a focus, our focus extends beyond these confines and addresses the crucial gap that's overlooked, where the inherent profitability of predatory schemes continues to thrive, especially in environments with vacancy decontrol. And we're committed to disrupting the status quo and offering solutions that safeguard both the rights and well-being of both tenants and the larger community. And we really try to create a housing ecosystem and landscape that is fair, sustainable, and inclusive. So,
okay, well, now I'm going to go into a few questions from your introduction. Disruptive solutions sounds like it could be kind of scary. What are we talking about when we mean disruptive solutions? Are we talking about breaking up the housing market? Are we talking about protests, rental strikes? What is it that you mean by the disruptive solutions?
So in disruptive solutions, I guess we're talking more so around working with individuals who could be private investors, community foundation fund holders, philanthropists, impact investors, community-owned assets, and landowners who understand the need of affordability and who understand that this is an inherent need in our community, but want to align their investment dollars into something like affordable housing and trying to where, you know, there's one way of how predatory investors and people and developers will throw their money into something like acquiring a building, renovating people, and then where do those renovated individuals go? Okay. We support the individuals who actually, you know, care about their overall community.
Well, let's break that down a bit. Let's presume that I'm an altruistic investor who has some money. I don't know how much money it would be, but I have some money that I want to invest somewhere. Is it a realistic option for someone to invest in the kind of rental rescue you're talking about? Can I pitch them on there's a return on your investment that is X percentage?
Yes. So how we do that is actually through our comprehensive financial modeling, where we can offer a competitive return on investment between whether it be 4% to even 4%, 6.5%, 7%, depending on the cost of the asset. And we'll basically take that off, take either a off-market building and figure out a way that we can create rent rolls that work for affordability and for market, or we support even just people who, like, let's say there's a nonprofit that owns a building and they want to offload that asset because they no longer have a board that can operate it at the capacity that they need to. So we can support actually figuring out a way that financially works and where people can get a return on investment.
Yeah. So when you're talking about this, the one thing that strikes me is that I think you made reference to predatory rent eviction. I'm going to come back to that in a bit. But it strikes me that what we're looking at is the possibility that investors are investing in properties that need improvement. Is that correct? Or are we looking at that their properties that just need somebody else to take them over?
So it can be both. And where for some buildings, we try to, for every building that we work with, we try to aim for a 40% affordability But we work in other ways. There are programs that work that exist at CMHC and private programs. And we will work with actually making it energy efficient. We'll work with maintaining 40% affordability. We'll work with if the numbers need to work, we really analyze every individualized solution and individualized potential investment opportunity. Yeah.
Okay. So if a person were interested in this, they could easily contact Rental Rescue if they have an interest in investment. But the other stuff sounds very intriguing as well. So there's the opportunity for energy efficiency to be put into a property, so on and so forth. So that gets down to a really important issue from my perspective as a city councilor. How do you work with the city of Hamilton and elsewhere to ensure that these properties are maintained as affordable units and that the city, as I often hear, is cooperating rather than putting obstructions in the way?
What we try to do is understand, I guess, what these buildings are currently zoned as, what are the needs in, what are the current rent rolls of these buildings, if the municipality, at least so in Hamilton, we have rental subsidies that we can offer and portable rental subsidies, so rent supplements and rental subsidies. And we work with nonprofit agencies and tenants who currently access this rental subsidy fund in order to maintain affordability over time and compete with rental market value. So let's say that there is before I even go into that, municipalities inherently should not be expected to, and cities and governments should not be expected to be putting the money up front for these developments. That is not a sustainable solution. That is the anomaly. That is the exception, not the rule. So how do we ensure that community investment is being put into affordable housing, and then nonprofits and municipalities create a systematized approach to sustain that affordability over time?
Folks, I like where Crystal's going with this, so I'm going to ask her to unpack that a little more. As many people are aware, I am very committed to affordable housing, but equally as committed to not having municipalities engage in it, because oftentimes we are virtual signaling without the capacity to actually do anything. Let me hear from you on this one. Why should municipalities not be involved on the ground in the way that you've just mentioned?
So municipalities should really be focused on, and governments as a whole and governing bodies should be focused on policies and the bureaucracy behind actually, the groundwork and being informed in the groundwork. So nonprofits and community investors and developers should be focused more so around actually making the affordable housing happen and creating solutions and referral programs and all of that to support the tenants and the people on the ground. But what Rental Rescue does is effectively become that intermediary between the nonprofits and agencies and community organizations, so that we can report on, we can streamline everything, and create that system within a micro ecosystem within Guelph for a housing solution, and then report all those numbers to the municipality. So the municipality is focused on actually creating, bylaws and supporting, taking down red tape and supporting ongoing efforts in affordability and retaining the affordability over 50 years, 100 years, however long, instead of actually creating developments, especially actually in the case where, the council can be reelected. There's a reelection every 3 to 4 years. How can you possibly expect council to create long-term solutions over 10-year periods when that isn't always the case for their term? So
you're suggesting that by looking at municipalities, we're looking at what is fundamentally an unstable business model, because we're constantly turning over our board of directors. Is that correct?
Effectively, it's not fair to expect a municipality to create a 10-year solution if that solution can constantly change every 4 years.
Okay. Well, what I'm going to do is, because I'm going to come back to that in a sec, because you mentioned a couple of words that are important to me, policy and red tape. But before I do that, what I'm hearing you say, rental rescue is, for all intents and purposes, is embracing a capitalist model of development, but with a bit of a twist. And what I heard was, you're talking in some senses, and I hope you can break this down, it's my words, compassionate capitalism.
Yes.
Is that correct?
I would say so. And we can't expect for capitalistic partners to, you know, to turn over and suddenly not make profits. That's not a reasonable expectation of for-profit partners. And we also can't expect for municipalities and governments to become developers all of a sudden. How do they have the capital or the expertise to do that? And similarly with not-for-profits, although not-for-profits are well-meaning, the capital and the knowledge and the skill set that's required is not necessarily within scope of work. So being able to work within the market players that exist and leverage the people that actually care about the community and leverage, you know, architectural firms that exist here, realtors that actually want to support affordable acquisition and retention, you know, environmental firms that exist here that want to support pro bono, let's say, in some of these new developments. Like, those are the types of people that we want to aggregate around and create a small ecosystem that can support this. This compassionate capitalistic.
Okay, so let's look at that ecosystem that you're talking about. In Rental Rescue, you strike me as having experts that you are involved with, people from the housing industry. Can you break that down a bit? Are we talking about just interested people who maybe were weekend renovation warriors, or are we talking about those who have expertise in subdivisions or something in between? What are we looking at with regards to your architects and your builders and so on?
So I would say that it's a mixture of, so it's the no parachute approach, right? If we were to come in, understand who exists here, who are the market players who have been vetted, and they have a history of caring about the buildings that they, who are the good landlords, who are the you know, environmental firms that care about outcomes, who have worked with CMHC and the outcomes there. And we try to understand those market players first, do our upfront research and due diligence, pre-due diligence, and then offer potential small micro solutions that are tangible and slowly to help like acquisition and development and all the rest of it. So some of our experts include, there's a national credit union that we work with. There is we work with Rotman School of Management, and the students there, as well as one of the instructors is one of my mentors. We work with one of the largest Ontario housing providers, affordable housing providers I think they are the largest Ontario.
I don't mind you using names if you feel that you wish, that's fine.
So for example, one group that, like, the first client that we worked with that was a nonprofit nonprofit entity was Victoria Park Community Homes, and they have over 3,000 affordable units.
Is that in Toronto?
That's in Hamilton, but across 7 or 9 housing service managers.
So I gather they can bring the knowledge and the depth of experience from having built larger projects to something like Rental Rescue or a manifestation that we might find in Guelph or elsewhere. And clearly they're committed to housing, and clearly this is a different approach to them. Related to that, what I find really interesting is you made mention of policy and red tape, and let's try to tie the two together. So Victoria Park or others clearly have experience with city councils, yeah, and with city staff. How does that benefit an organization like Rescue, Rental Rescue, as opposed to, say, an individual like me who maybe wants to go in front of city council and do something good?
Well, we are always stronger as a collective. And when we understand the kind, like when we all aggregate and then understand what the overarching trends are that we need to resolve, then we can come together as an aggregate, as a collective to find potential solutions and then apply. Like it's a knowledge sharing platform, right? Where instead of one person trying to make an impact in one building or one potential space, we come at it as a portfolio approach where any of the individuals who want to, let's say, invest in a building or help a new development, or they have land and they want to know how to optimize on it. It is much, we as a collective are much stronger presenting that to City Council as a portfolio and then coming together with outcomes as a portfolio and a streamlined, like we all know how many affordable units we want to get. What is the average, you know, rent roll of a rental unit that cost? Let's have fair market rent. What's the deeply affordable? If we come together as a group and report on these numbers as a group, we can actually almost summarize it in a one page and then send it to council. And that can help inform the potential, you know, next steps that council would propose in your meetings, right?
So you're just cutting down red tape, as such, as we might say, by making it efficient.
Yes.
And related to that red tape, I want to address some of the concerns that people might have, and those might relate to anything from zoning to getting the plumbing and the electricity into a property. Just break down some of the challenges with working with city councils and working with city staff that you think Rental Rescue might benefit from seeing some expeditious approach to building permits and approvals.
Well, what we can recognize, I think, in many municipalities is that municipal staff tend to be kind of but less experienced, or they tend to be over committed in the work that they're expected to achieve. And with Rental Rescue's model, we work with the private sector individuals who have more capacity and who have larger staffs and are able to produce at a quicker rate. Whereas the municipalities can focus on collecting the data from that and then supporting like an overarching kind of strategy in implementation for the cities. But yeah, we're working more so with the private sector individuals who, and frankly, a lot of municipalities end up losing all their staff to private sector players, right? Because they can pay more. So they end up losing municipalities end up losing their staff to private sector individuals. However, private sector people do tend to still care about the community and they want to help. And if that means that they're associated with their corporation, or if they're a individual within a corporation who want to provide some services, either volunteer, pro bono, or subsidized, then you know, we can work through that, right?
Now, I don't believe that everything that a city does is red tape when it comes to building. I was wondering if you could also point out some of the things that are really positive. I often am hearing, and I'm filled with dread for this, that we should be putting housing in areas that are not necessarily zoned for housing, or that are not necessarily really appropriate, such as, say, a brownfield where there has been significant toxicity within the soil and so on. I was wondering if you could talk about what the good things are that communities, that cities can offer to ensure that people not only have a roof over their head, but have a safe roof over their head.
Well, when it comes to, let's say, a toxic soil, you can't actually develop there. And even if you were to, it would cost an arm and a leg to make it so that the soil is developable, right? But what some municipalities that I've worked in have done is they will take those upfront due diligence pieces, like, you know, conducting the soil study, so that at least the nonprofits and non-market developers don't have to incur those costs. There's, you know, pre-approved development, like pre-approved schematics and designs that have been developed in other parts of Ontario, where the municipalities can actually like accept those, that like almost like a playbook of buildings that can be developed in Guelph. They can offer, municipalities have access to surplus land, or, you know, city owned buildings that can be redeveloped or revitalized. And even just advocacy around affordability. And there's one municipality that I've worked in where the council didn't agree at all that affordability was an issue, and that affordable housing was not even within scope. So there are ways in which some municipalities can focus on that. But the fact that we're sitting here today and a councilman actually cares about affordability, that is acknowledging the issue and trying to, you know, explore the potential solutions for it. So,
well, I've always been very, very cynical about this, if you want the truth. I've hated the idea that we talk about affordable housing. My argument has always been all housing is affordable to somebody who can afford it. And that's been the problem. So I want to get into a couple of the issues to make housing not just affordable, but available as well. Now, you had mentioned pre-approved designs, and I had heard from the Minister of Housing, the Federal Minister of Housing, that we were going to revive World War II style designs for housing as pre-approved opportunities, and then suddenly it disappeared. But my question for you is, what's the role of CMHC and the federal government in looking at making housing available to people that they actually don't have to live in fear that they might have to leave because they can no longer afford to pay for it? What about pre-approved designs? What about CMHC? What role do they play right now?
So I would say that CMHC and kind of the federal government as a whole, they have a role in supporting municipalities and local individuals or local corporations, I should say, and nonprofits to actually develop and create the solutions that work for each individualized space, because what works in Toronto might not work in Guelph and in Oakville, which also might not work in, you know, Meaford, Collingwood, Georgian Bay area, which also might not work in Indigenous land, right? And so the federal government can really support in offering funds and long-term solutions based on affordability outcomes. So, and I say affordability, but it's more so around supporting vulnerable populations in retaining the housing that exists, in addition to supporting the vulnerable populations in economic viability. So actually, you know, creating workforce housing that is attached to the individual's income and rent geared to income and 30% of their income. And if we're also creating system responses alongside people's jobs and retaining their jobs and increasing their income, then we're not just focused on one specific population. We're focused on and vulnerable populations and low income. We're actually focused on transitioning people from low income into moderate income and into, you know, from deeply affordable to affordable market rents to hopefully market rents too, right? And we're actually like supporting local money flow, local you know, money and local economies.
Well, let's get to the greenbacks then, because what I'm hearing you say, and something that I believe, so I hope I'm just not channeling myself here, that in some senses, the affordable housing crisis, such as it's been framed, is not so much the problem as the symptom. That I'm hearing that it is not about the affordability of housing, it's about the affordability of everything, and that wages and income have not kept pace with that. Is that correct, or am I just echoing my own my own thoughts.
No, you're 100% correct. There was a study recently published by the Canadian Housing and Renewal Association that attached the productivity of a city to economic viability and housing, and how we actually need to create more workforce housing and middle income housing in order for people to actually for local money to continue moving within the city, right? And when people don't have to worry about the housing that they live in, and when their incomes are at when there is a reasonable cost of living, then everyone benefits. We're only as strong as our weakest members of society, and being able to support our vulnerable members of society through job creation and job supports, then you know, we're all better for it. So
I'm going to ask you the ugly question now, and I want to frame it that way deliberately. More and more, and I'm afraid of this, I have to admit, I am hearing people talking about immigration and talking about this whole problem is caused by immigration. Do you have any comments on that, or can you break that down at all, so that we make certain that we are not going down a road that is entirely misguided?
So I am a child of immigrants, and knowing that my parents came here, my mom actually came here 30 years ago. She was able to buy a house for 100 grand at the time when she was 23, and working three jobs as a nanny and a PSW. So knowing how you know, immigrants can really support the workforce, and especially in supporting, you know, the lower wage workforce, and slowly move and creating roots in Canada, and giving individual immigrants an opportunity to actually, you know, create a better life for themselves. And I probably wouldn't be sitting here in front of you today if my parents didn't make the sacrifices they made moving from the Philippines and trying to create a better life for us, right? And that's ultimately all any parent wants to do for their kid, and that's ultimately what immigrants can do for society.
So what I'm hearing you say is that throughout the history of Canada, immigration has been a net positive in terms of both the economy and our culture and our vitality. It strikes me that one of the things that immigration will bring is our capacity to build more homes. Just comment on that quickly. Two things that seem to be missed in this equation are the costs of building, including renovation, and also labor shortages. Let's hear about the cost of building. What are we looking at in terms of renovations and also building new units? What kind of cost can we expect? Are you able to break it down to square foot?
So to square foot might be a little difficult, but I can tell you that that on average it can cost between $500,000 at least for a new development of a unit, whereas in acquisition and revitalization of buildings, we're looking at even as low as $200,000, $250,000, $300,000 per unit. That's a significant, you know, difference in units. And on top of that, we recognize that there's, for every one newly built unit, we lose 15. So for every newly built affordable unit, we lose 15 affordable units. If we're not actually retaining the affordability that exists, then we cannot, like, no matter how many new units we build, we are still at a net negative of supply. And that's the 15 units is really what Rental Rescue is focused on.
I'm having a hard time understanding that. Why is there that ratio of one new unit equals 15 lost? That doesn't make any sense to me at all. Can you tell me a bit about that, please?
So one new development, let's say that there's a new unit, a building of, you know, let's say 12 affordable units being developed. While that in the duration of the time that it takes to develop those new units, we are losing the existing stock of affordable housing, whether that be from predatory, you know, keys for cash buildings. It can be people who are rent evicting, or like private investors, small investors who are buying up the other units and then, you know, pushing people out and actually telling them to move on. So where actually in Hamilton and across the GTA, there are these seminars that are happening where they'll try to, like, these individuals will market it as an investment opportunity, a seminar, and they'll try to bring people into a room and to get them to invest in purchase a building and teach the tenants how to move on from their affordable units, which ultimately just means give them, you know, $1,000 to $5,000 to $15,000 to get them to move out. And then ultimately they get that $15,000. They can no longer find a building that a unit that was at that $700 rate that they're now getting kicked out of, and they end up on the street or they end up in social systems.
Yeah, it sounds like an endeavor that would appear to be noble at the surface, but really in a sense is Russian roulette housing, from what I'm hearing you say. Now, that leads to another question for me. I often look in the real estate pages and I saw this sweet little property that is maybe 500 square feet that's for sale for about $400,000, and it's in bad shape and it's a teardown. Just give me your take on the principle of teardowns and what is the net positive or net negative effect of that kind of infill?
So if you need to tear down a unit, it should be, or a building, it should be because either one, it is no longer structurally sound in order to keep the units, or two, that you want to densify. But even in the densification process, so if there's a 12 unit, there's a possibility of, or let's say it's a triplex. There is a possibility of actually increasing that densification to 6 or 12. Yes, you should do that. You should try to, you know, incorporate the 12 units, but only if, you know, it's not, well, firstly, if you're not actually kicking the three tenants out, or if you can find affordable units for those three tenants, or secondly, to actually, you know, only for temporary use, they're going to be moving out and then coming back into a new unit that they can continue to live in at reasonable affordable rates.
Yes. Our guest today is Crystal Valencia from Rental Rescue, and Crystal works in the Hamilton Oakville area. And because of that, I'm going to ask her a question about Hamilton. Crystal, I know you're very passionate about housing, and Hamilton has been on the forefront of preserving the green belt and reducing its urban footprint. In other words, trying to avoid urban sprawl. You, as a housing activist, where do you stand on what Hamilton has done and how we can intensify and not have to expand our urban boundaries?
Something that I really love about Hamilton's methods is that the municipality and the people around are really willing to figure out solutions to just fix what already exists and densify what already exists. For example, there are additional dwelling units that people will actually add on to their laneways and to their backyards. There's this one company that I work with, one nonprofit, who creates these smaller, almost like tiny homes, but they're smaller units on existing properties with support from the individuals who own these larger houses and backyards, and they'll build these units in the backyards of people's homes where the tenant will ultimately live and will continue to create relationships with the homeowner, and they'll pay them rent and they'll help with actually like building these spaces. So that's one example of a unit or of a method that Hamilton has taken on. Another is with, obviously everyone knows Indwell and the other larger housing developers, where those larger housing affordable housing developers will support Rental Rescue and other small non-market developers with expertise and with schematics and their knowledge and capacities. So
I also am somewhat skeptical of laneway houses and accessory units and so on, but I'm hearing you say something different. I'm hearing you say that they are part of a solution, that we can use excess land on large lots. How do you feel about opening up our zoning principles to accommodate 3 and 4 plexes throughout a city like Guelph or like Hamilton?
So I think that 3 and 4 plexes make sense, right? Especially if there are existing buildings around where you're mentioning that have height restriction or that can be built higher. I mean, what's one more unit, right? Or if it's a single family home, what's only a few more units that a homeowner can ultimately benefit from for long-term housing, right? Like and supporting affordability as well as actually making an income, a higher income for their own benefit. So
Are laneway houses and the opening up of development to 3 and 4 plexes, are they the answer, or do we need more than that?
I think that there's always more. There's always room for more, in small incremental steps, though, right? So if we start with 3 and 4 plexes and we control the variables for failure and we prototype it, right? We do it in small subsections, figure out what works, what doesn't, and then continue to refine our process as we move. That is the solution, right?
Now, 40 years ago in a galaxy far, far away, I was involved in co-op and nonprofit housing. I think you were probably just a twinkle in Princess Leia's eye at that point. But the question that I really have for you is a serious one. Are land trusts, co-ops, and nonprofits still an answer, and do they require government, provincial and federal government assistance to be part of that answer?
100% co-ops and nonprofits and community land trusts are a part of the solution. And ultimately, community assets are, and community individuals are, the only potential operators for and housing providers for community and deeply affordable housing, because they don't have any incentive to lose that affordable units, right? Whereas if you continue, like, we can't continue to be supporting for-profit developers who have no social conscience or soul, because they will all, like, that affordability solution is only temporary. Whereas community land trusts and nonprofits and co-ops and cooperative and co-ownership even and co-housing, those are the individuals that actually have some skin in the game and actually want to retain affordability in perpetuity. So absolutely they're a part of the solution. And absolutely they need support from federal and local, all levels of government.
Okay, so because some people will not be familiar with these things, could you just help us define land trusts and co-housing just a bit, just a short breakdown of those so that we're all more familiar with?
So community land trusts is where individuals, let's say there's an estate who wants to donate their excess land, they can donate it to this corporation, a community land trust, where then an estate could donate to a community land trust, an incorporated nonprofit typically, and this land asset will turn into something that benefits the community overall, where you can create more housing, you can create commercial spaces, you can and that incorporation, the community corporation, will actually support the development of that, and they will own the asset, the land asset, which oftentimes is about 20% of the development costs of any new development. So that will really help actually leverage. They can leverage that asset to develop. And co-housing is where there will be let's say a group of individuals, a group of tenants who will co-develop, and direct a development, and then ultimately become members and owners of the housing that they informed.
This might sound like a fairly simple question, and I hope that it is, but I'm not certain. I'm very experienced with what's happening and what has happened for decades in Holland. And Holland has approximately 60% rental market. In Canada and the United States, the principle is, I'll take a line from The Apprenticeship of Duddy Kravitz, man is nothing without land, that we need to own our homes. It's my thought that Rental Rescue believes that particular model doesn't necessarily work. Might work for some, but it doesn't work for others. Do we need to expand our rental properties in Canada and in places like Guelph and Hamilton?
Of course, we 100% need to expand our rental property, not just in new developments and individuals who will invest in rental developments, but also in, we need to create supply of rental units. And as you mentioned, like land ownership and ownership of a house is definitely a goal, but it is not an I would say that a lot of the millennials, so a lot of my generation, we've lost the dream of owning a building, and ultimately, all people want is just a safe space to live where they don't have to worry about, selling their shirt just to pay it. That's I think and rental, just housing in general, is a basic human right. And as we continue to just find more people that understand that and that care about that and want to practice business and operate with that mindset, that's all we care about. That's what we need.
All right. So now you've raised a big issue for me. Tell me about housing as a human right, something to which I do subscribe. What do you mean by that?
When a person has some level of housing to where they know they have a safe shelter to go home to, all of the other pieces in their life can fall into place, right? Because when you have a home, actually, I'll use the opposite example, where if a person doesn't have a home, how can they go home to somewhere that they'll shower? Where are they going to print a resume? Where are they going to be holding their work clothes? All of these things are you would think that they're such a basic thing, but if a person doesn't have a home to even shower before a job interview, how are they supposed to focus on anything else, right? How are they supposed to get a job?
So in your opinion, is shelter really fundamental and really basic to avoiding some of the greater social ills that we seem to be experiencing right now?
Well, I think housing is the fundamental piece before anything else can really be focused on, right? Where it's the housing first model, right? Where if a person has a house where they can choose where they want to live, they know that it actually, reaches their fundamental needs. If it's, let's say, a single mother who has a son, she shouldn't have to be living in a bachelor basement apartment with her son, and that it's not appropriate for them to have, for the son to have an open space with the mom either. And if there's two kids, let's say there's a daughter and a son, it might not be appropriate for them all to live in one space. But that is a reality for a lot of families. So if we're creating housing based on what the needs are of our vulnerable populations than and where they can have a two-bedroom apartment somewhere that works for them, then that's where we need to develop and continue to supply. But we need to understand that data first.
Now, Crystal, you've raised a couple of really interesting issues for me. It's somewhat personal as well. But before I get to the personal, a broad question, a big question really is, why do housing developers want to build large estate homes rather than building the kind of housing that you've just described, the kind of housing that would assure that a mother with a child might be able to have a roof over their head, have a shower, and have a kitchen? Why is it that we seem to be so focused on large lots and what people call monster home?
Well, the McMansions, right? The McMansions are what can make the most money, right? And that's, we live in this lustrous kind of society, whereas housing is not something of lust or profit. It is a human right. It's a basic human, it's a component of basic need. And so I think that developers who are predatory can focus more so on making those profits. Yeah.
Okay. So you're differentiating different kinds of developers, and I'm not going to get into any names on anything like this, but the other thing that it raises for me, and it's a personal question. I'm now retired. I live with my wife and we live in a large home. Am I the problem?
I think that if you live in a large home and it would cost you the same amount to buy a condo as it does for you to live in the home that you currently own, you are not the problem, but you can certainly contribute to the solution.
And certainly one of the options for us as we get into our golden years will be to downsize, as you've perhaps suggested. But then it raises another issue for me. It's perhaps one that is a housing finance issue. So somebody living in a larger home that could be converted to, say, 2, 3, maybe even 4 apartments. How does Rental Rescue, and how can, say, government support like CMHC presently and ideally address the issues of the challenges of housing finance?
So if an individual wants to densify in their own home, there should be other opportunities like financing for densification, or creating a secondary suite, or being able to create more units within your home. But it's also not fair to assume that a retired couple would have the capacity or the skill or the desire to even collect rents from 4 different units within their homes. So it's important to create the infrastructure and social supports around that type of model before we actually put money into supporting individuals to actually develop it, right? Creating the systems first before throwing money at it wouldn't solve the problem either. Yeah.
Now, another interesting issue for me is because this is not our house could not be turned into 4 units because we have a very low basement. Now, you or I could live in there quite comfortably because the ceiling is still reasonably high. What about building standards that in some senses are perhaps out of line with the need for basic shelter because the roof is too low or something like that? Do we need to reconsider what is adequate in terms of space and so on for people? Or are these pretty good principles that we have right now?
Well, I think that there's certainly room for creating principles that work for people, right? And obviously an individual, like I actually have an example of this where an individual who had, it was a single mother who had a quadriplegic daughter. She was required to move into a basement unit with only stairs. So every day she had to hold her daughter up and down the stairs and then bring her daughter's wheelchair up and down the stairs just to live, just for basic living. That type of, the fact that that unit is where they had to reside because that was the only option for them, that is an inappropriate standard of living. So increasing the standard of living, increasing the expectation of standards of living that relate to people, that the inherent needs that and fundamental needs that people, you know, are experiencing, then you know, that is more so, I think, where we need to inform our policies and standard and living standard movement.
We are going to go to questions from other people in a couple of minutes. But before we do that, I'm hoping that we can discuss something that I'm hoping you're familiar with. And that's AODA legislation or accessibility in Ontario concerns, because we're supposed to be completely accessible within a year, and I'm not seeing it happening. How does that affect the housing market, and how does Rental Rescue address issues of accessibility?
So we support issues of accessibility through, well, creating prototypes that work for seniors, that work for individuals with complex disabilities, understanding what already exists in a city and examples of housing that works for accessibility purposes, and then, you know, replicating those same types of housing in new development. Typically that would be easier, but in retrofit renovation, for a big key issue or challenge that most places face is that unless it is already accessible, they can't, it costs exorbitant amounts to retrofit renovate to become accessible, right?
And that was my other concern. I was wondering what the impact might be on housing. And clearly what you're stating is it's a cost that we must accept, whether it's on sidewalks and streets or it's in housing, if we wish to be a society that is accessible and is available to all members of it, from the time that we wake up in the morning to the time that we wake up the next morning, we need to recognize that accessibility is a right. Is that what you're suggesting?
Certainly. And I think that especially when it comes to the new development of housing, as in this new phase of era of housing that we're getting into, if we're living in a city where there's an aging population, you know that aging population will likely need accessible housing, but they will also need healthcare and a strong healthcare system that will support an aging population. And they need the individuals who are working, PSWs, and live in individuals and doctors. How are we going to incentivize doctors and nurses and PSWs to live here if a person who is a PSW cannot afford to live in the city? So co-creating these small ecosystems of that, you know, support the infrastructure around the system, as well like informed by the populations that it serves, that is what we need to do. Those individualized solutions, that's what Rental Rescue does.
And your passion clearly comes out. And with that, I'm going to turn the mic over to Morgan, who has a question. And Tanya, I believe you might have a couple of questions as well.
Thank you so much, Phil. Krista, thank you so much for such an incredible source of being such an incredible source of knowledge through this. This is all really new to me. I am a renter. I'm a renter by choice. I no longer wish to own a home. I did own a home. And that's the first question that Tanya actually sent to me. You know, people say that renting is flushing money down the toilet. In North America, we've got this mindset where in order to have any kind of security in life, you have to own your own home. What are some of the advantages of being a renter?
Some of the advantages of being a renter is exactly like, you know, renting a car, right? Once you own the asset, absolutely, you know, there are ways to leverage that, but it also becomes a liability, right? And there are maintenance costs, there are property taxes, there are things that, you know, some people like yourself don't actually want to deal with the headache. And so the appeal of renting is that with a lump sum that you pay every month, you don't have to worry about you know, the property taxes. And in cases with condos, you don't have to worry about snow removal. You don't have any of those additional kind of headaches that come with owning a house, right?
And thank you. And those are the exact reasons why I don't want to own a home anymore. I don't want to be involved, like in my rental where I am, while I've been there, the water heater has had to be replaced. The pump that takes the waste out of my basement apartment had to be replaced. A staircase had to be replaced. I don't want to deal with that kind of stuff. So my other question, as a person that's on ODSP that is no longer able to be a reliable employee, I can't get on this model that you were talking about. I can't get to a point where my income is going to be any more than what I get on ODSP. So for someone like me living in Hamilton, if I were to call up Rental Rescue and say, hey, I'm getting evicted, I'm on ODSP, I have nowhere to go, can you explain what the process for the individual would be like?
So for an individual, let's say on ODSP, what we work through is creating that portfolio of that housing of housing that exists, and where the financial modeling comes in is that as a renter or as a homeowner, do you know how much your neighbors pay in mortgages and in rents? No, right? And that's because that is an individual's, you know, that's a privacy thing. So similarly, if we were to apply that where if you don't know how much your neighbor pays, and we create these mixed income housing where if you are on ODSP, you should only be paying 30%, you should only be paying your housing allocation to your rent. But someone who perhaps has a higher income, as a working individual, has the capacity to pay a higher rent, should incur those costs. And ultimately, at the end of the day, that's where the balance comes in.
Before I pass it over to Tanya for our wrap up and to thank you, I'm just going to ask you a personal question. I am a homeowner who owns a second property. And the reason I own a second property is when my mother passed away, we purchased a property for our daughter who lives in Toronto and who is planning on moving to Guelph. Now, she's not here yet because her job doesn't allow her to do that. So we rent it out. Am I part of the solution, or am I part of the problem, or is it different than that?
I think that it's completely normal for a parent to want to support their child that is a generational wealth piece, right? You don't want for your daughter to have to incur the exorbitant cost of trying to buy a house here after the fact, which makes sense. Where I think you could be a part of the problem, which I hope you're not doing this, which I'm sure you're not doing this, is that you would, if you were to, you know, take the tenant that lives there, who's been there for 10 years, then kick them out because you want to try and increase their rent by, you know, 50%. That's where the problem lies. But you know, if you are, I'm sure you are a compassionate landlord, and I'm sure that you're supporting your tenants in that way, and that they're in a livable space. So that's, you're not a part of the problem in that case. Yeah.
Darn, I'm going to sleep better tonight. Actually, with this particular property, we're just holding on to it. We are not planning on increasing the rent at all. At some point, regrettably, we might have to ask the tenants to look elsewhere. But for the longer term, they're there. Tanya, I think you have some announcements.
Crystal, I want to thank you very much for coming to Breezy Breakfast and answering all our questions. We have learned a lot today. There is a 2024 pre-budget consultations happening. The Standing Committee on Finance and Economic Affairs, they're having these pre-budget consultations. The closest one to Guelph is in Cambridge, and it's happening on Thursday, January the 18th. If you don't want to speak, you can write in some comments. And please do that by 7 p.m. on Thursday, February 1st. If you do want to speak, please register by Monday, January the 8th, and that's next Monday. The committee will stream live from location when available. So for the link to the webcast, times of streaming and availability, please visit the Legislative Assembly website, and that's at ola.org. And if you want to register to comment, please go to ola.org/en/apply-committees. Again, that's the pre-budget consultations, the Standing Committee on Finance and Economic Affairs. Next week on Breezy Breakfast, we're going to be talking about, for lack of a better title, drugs on the streets of Guelph. We are going to have a variety of guests who understand the nuances of this troubling situation. Coming soon on Breezy Breakfast, we'll be talking about the state of the Fifth Estate. I believe that's a wrap for today. Again, thank you very much, Crystal.
That's all for this week. Thanks for tuning in. Our theme music is Tranquility by Jules Germ. We're on CFRU 93.3 FM every Monday at 9 a.m. or check out our podcast at breezybreakfastradiohour.podbean.com. Better yet, join us in person at 8 a.m. every Thursday at the Rise and Shine Restaurant, 44 MacDonnell in downtown Guelph. Breezy Breakfast is a non-profit volunteer initiative that's been running for the past 8 years. Its intent is to raise issues that are newsworthy or culturally pertinent that affect Guelph and our wider listening area. Issues range from municipal matters and provincial projects or other topics such as the library project or book and film recommendations. Special thanks to Bev at the Rise and Shine, who keeps us fueled up and ready to roll. Check out their menu at riseshinebrunch.ca. Happy New Year to our listeners everywhere from Breezy Breakfast, where we discuss hot topics over a cup of Bev's hot coffee.